basketball, a game of giants. And there's number 99, George Mikan, one of the greatest.
Perhaps the most complete player the game has ever seen. The Lakers captain, Elgin Baylor.
2 seconds, 1 second. West throws it up.
Jerry West made it from the other side of the mid-point stripe.
Ford sends it to Kareem. Sky hook up and good. Lakers win.
Magic down the middle, just what I thought. A hook shot at 12. Good!
Shaquille fade away.
Giants for the win. James puts up the three. Oh, it's good!
Doncic on the drive. Step back. Puts it up. Puts it in! With 5 tenths of a second remaining!
What's up, Laker fans? Come back for the ages. You're listening to the Laker Film Room podcast. I'm Pete, joined by Darius. And last night, a classic game four, where the New York Knicks had the biggest comeback in NBA Finals history, coming back from a 29-point deficit in the second half. D, the game opened up just like all the others did, with the Spurs jumping all over the Knicks and getting a double-digit lead. It really flipped the script in the first minute. Cat picked up his second foul on an excellent challenge by the Spurs that was initially called as a foul against Wemby, but they caught Cat for hooking his arm. And one of the main storylines of this series has been when Cat's been on the floor, the Knicks have been in control, and when he hasn't been, the Spurs have been. And so gives him that two fouls really quickly. Mitchell Robinson comes in and is gassed after 5-6 minutes. Hook Porty has to come in, their third string center, and Cat's chatting them up. And throughout all of that, the Spurs are knocking down every jump shot. They go up by 19 at the end of the first quarter. And the way that the series has gone, the second quarter has generally been what's flipped the game right after that. Again, double digits in every single game through the first four games, the Spurs have been up. But that wasn't the case in the second quarter. Spurs opened it up even more, continuing that hot shooting, setting an NBA Finals record for 14 threes in the first half and score 76 points in the first half, but only 30 in the second half in one of the biggest collapses. Credit to the Knicks, of course, but there's no way you beat the other team by that much without some cooperation from the other team. But just an incredible comeback, culminating in an OG Anunoby tip-in that they'll be playing for the next 50 years in highlight packages about the NBA Finals to a crowd. Like I was thinking last night, and you alluded to this in a couple texts as well, I could not imagine being a fan of either of those teams, because I was kind of a mess just as an, I don't really have a dog in this, like, rooting for a long series, which it might not be. That was a killer way to lose, but I just couldn't imagine the feelings on either side of it. So, D, I'd love to hear your thoughts on a classic game four.
Man, so an unreal ending. It's the ending and sort of the pandemonium of that moment and during to even after, where Cat screaming and the hugs and the emotion of everyone but Anunoby. Because Anunoby's the most stone-faced, like, emotionless player ever. It was so hilarious to me because his affect just never changes.
Never.
And he's just one of those sorts of guys. Brunson, very similar.
Yeah. They've got a few serious customers on that team. Yeah.
Right. But everyone just going crazy. The crowds, some of the world's most famous people basically being reduced to bubbling children, essentially.
They showed a shot after the game of Chalamet, who's just like, oh, my God. Oh my, like, yeah. Did that just happen? Just absolutely stunned.
I thought the crowd was just an amazing crowd, and it was a much better crowd than I thought from game three, just in terms of how animated they were and how locked into what their responsibilities were for that night. They definitely got low when the team got down, but they were frothing at the mouth for like any sort of play to get them back into the game. And I thought as the Knicks started to walk down the Spurs in the second half, I thought the crowd understood the task at hand as well as the players did. Like, this is what we're doing. We're going to be as loud, pushing them in the right direction for every single moment.
Bro, what happened in that second half? I described a lot of the first half, but what happened in that comeback?
I thought it was a combination of the Spurs getting a little comfortable. I thought there was a little bit of hubris from the Spurs as well.
Yes.
In that they're sort of, well, we'll just keep doing what we've been doing and like it'll start to work again, and like, we'll take the same threes we were taking before. All of that stuff, that was the Spurs collapse part of things. It was them not recognizing what needed to shift and that what adjustments needed to be made. No one took leadership on the court to sort of reorganize what the team needed to do. I didn't think Mitch Johnson called timeouts. I actually thought Johnson coached the first half. I thought he should have coached more in the second half like he did in the first half.
What's the difference?
They were up by 20-something points, mm-hmm. Pete. And any single time the Knicks made any sort of play that looked like the momentum was shifting, Johnson was calling a timeout.
Yeah, little 4 points in a row, 5 points in a row from the Knicks, immediate timeout. And you didn't see that in the second half.
No, it was just like, oh, the game went from 26 to 21, timeout. And he's like in their ears, basically, like, get back to this, get back to that. And in the second half, none of that was there. And I thought that the fatigue started to set in for San Antonio as well. They go as Wemby goes. And I get that like Harper and Castle are like physical specimens and monsters in their own right. But Wemby, I thought, started to settle way more for jumpers. The team overall started to settle way more for jumpers. And those jumpers just didn't go in at the 80% rate they were going in the first half. And they never decided, you know what, maybe we should drive more. Maybe we should get back to doing this. And like the only player who looked like he had that mentality at all, Castle has it always to a certain degree. But Dylan Harper was the guy who I thought was like really in attack mode and trying to get downhill as often as possible. And he just didn't play very much in the second half, Pete. And instead, it was De'Aaron Fox. And I thought it was a combination of Fox taking the reins, Mitch Johnson not necessarily organizing the team or getting them back on track the way that they needed to be, and the Knicks having that quintessential Knicks belief of no lead is safe against us. We've come back from huge deficits in the past. They had one in the conference finals against the Cavs, Pete, where they were down 20-something points with 8 minutes left in a game, and they walked down the Cavs. And this is where the belief from the players in the building, the environment of, we still got an opening here. Mm-hmm. We still got a pathway here. That goes so far in games like this that I just think that it was a combination of all of that stuff. And that's why we should talk down on what the Spurs did for sure. But so many other teams, even in a finals game, they might just be like, okay, it's not our night.
Yep.
We're going to not lay down, but, you know, like go through the motions a little bit more. And the Knicks didn't really do that at all.
And it started with Brunson, you know, I know that it's easy to define being clutch as in the last 5 minutes of a 5-point game. And I do think there should be sort of objective parameters around it to a degree. But there are a bunch of different times of the game to be clutch. And I think he had 15 points in the second quarter, which, no, what does it matter? They were down by 26 or whatever it was at halftime. He kept them in that game. They were within screaming distance. It was a long way away, but they were at least attached. And then he did the same thing in the third quarter. And there was a urgency to the Knicks combined with the hubris line that you said earlier about San Antonio really stood out to me. There was like a three by Champagne, for example, in the third quarter, who I didn't think was particularly impactful, good or bad, right? Not call him out in an overall way, but he took this contested three with like 20 seconds left on the clock. I'm like, are you Ray Allen?
There were so many early offense.
Bro, yeah, it was early offense, but he wasn't open on that shot. It was a good contest. If you're stepping into an open three, by all means, take that shot. There were so many time score situation mistakes from the Spurs that, as a former high school coach, that's one of the things that, you know, 16-year-olds do dumb shit all the time on the court. That's like, you know, we're up by four, right? You don't need to drive to the basket. And then the Fox play at the end and all of that, that there was really that combination. But there was an urgency from the Knicks that started with Brunson that was like, no, we've got to go, and we've got to go right now, that they were able to cut it down in a way where it's like, oh, it's 16 points now.
Them being able to get it down to the teens going into the fourth quarter, I thought was a huge accomplishment from them, because with 3-point variance, there's so much time in a game. It could easily go from 15 to 9 in 12 seconds of game action. Mm-hmm. Oh, we made a three. Oh, turnover. We hit another three in transition and suddenly it's nine. That's not what happened last night. I'm just saying that a 15-point lead can go down to nothing mm-hmm. in a minute. And it did go from like 16 to 12, 12 to 10, 10 back to 12, 12 to 9. And then I remember when it got to single digits, I was just like, they're in this. There's 6 minutes left or 5 minutes left. And it's single digits. Like all they have to do is just play their game and they're just going to continue to walk them down.
And I thought they did a great job on the defensive end. Let's go to break here. I want to talk about that and keep going. Beyond the urgency and hubris and all the things that can come along with going up by 25 plus points early in the game, I thought the Knicks really adjusted to Wemby as the role man. That had been the story I've thought for the last game and a half or so, is he had really been terrorizing them around the basket. And before Wemby started becoming really jump shot heavy, he had tried to roll to the basket a bit more. And I thought there was a combination of way better pressure on the ball and ball denial from the Knicks. But also when Wemby was rolling to the rim, it wasn't just a one-man job. They did a great job of swarming him in ways that he had some difficult attempts around the basket that he just was rushing and missing. And he's capable of making shots that nobody else can make. It's crazy. Like the ball goes in for him in a different way than anybody else in the league. I've never seen anything like it, but they did a great job of swarming him.
The tip-ins, the announcing crew was all over in terms of like how good his hands are, but it helps when he grabs an NBA ball like a grapefruit, essentially. Or the way that you and I grab like a tennis ball or something. It's unreal, but he's got great dexterity. Because he's been so tall his entire life, the angles at which he plays at around the basket are just not familiar to regular people.
Nope. Usually when I'm watching a basketball game, I could be like, oh, that's off. That's at a pretty high clip. Like, I'm so familiar with these shots. They repeat different players, but you're familiar enough with these guys and their game and just what a good shot is and isn't. He makes all sorts of shots that I'm like, that I had no idea that was going in.
His ability to tip the ball when he's not even facing the basket, these are controlled tips. He's not just like batting at the ball, or he's like, nope, I'm going to twist my wrist this way and flick it this way. And it goes softly off the glass and just taps in. He does it with both hands. It's really one of the most impressive parts of his game for a player that impresses in all of these amazing ways, right? It's just like, how are you tipping the ball with your head behind the backboard and your arm sort of reached out in this weird way? He's jumping and twisting. He's like pirouetting on one foot because he can like reach up and basically touch the rim without even jumping. Just all of that stuff is impressive. And so to your point, I thought in the first half, it was demoralizing in a way. They were just throwing the ball. His catch radius is ridiculous. So they were just throwing these like almost like a back shoulder fade into the end zone by a quarterback, right? Like throwing it to Megatron or Randy Moss or someone like that. And just like, oh, Wemby's just going to tap it and tap it again. And then it just goes in. And he was feeling himself in that first half to the point where he's yelling at Mitchell Robinson and like clapping all hard when he gets Towns out of the game with foul trouble. And it's just a lot of, I'm better than you and I'm going to prove it. And then in the second half, the Knicks, I thought, started to wall up the lane more and more. They were very physical with him throughout. And again, this was another game where there's only one day off between the games, Pete. And I thought that Wemby does this, and he's done it throughout the playoffs, where he gives you his best shot in the first half or in the first like 25 minutes of the game. And it's just like, well, what do you have left to close? And I thought he didn't have as much. Mm-hmm. He had the wherewithal to make that tough 18-footer over Towns down the stretch, but he didn't have a lot of like shot-making ability, and it looked like his legs were not all of the way there to me.
It made me think of Luka, actually, and Brunson obviously being the example of this for the Knicks, but one of the weaknesses of the Spurs, I believe, is that their best player, their superstar, is not somebody that you give the ball to at half court when everything's stagnated and it turns into that type of game. That was Fox that took on that role. He had 44 touches in that half, and they generated like 0.4 points per possession on those touches. He only touched the paint like five times. But the guy that you give the ball to on the perimeter near half court when the game slows down in that way, and your superstar being two separate players, is something that only describes the Spurs amongst really the elite teams.
It reminds me of the Lakers formula from the Kobe, Shaq, and Kobe Powell years, especially the Shaq years, where it's just like Shaq was clearly the best player or was viewed as the best player. He was the guy who won a league MVP and won all of the finals MVPs. But at the end of a close game, it was not give the ball to Shaq. It was they're giving the ball to Kobe at the top of the floor. And in this scenario with the Spurs, if Wemby is Shaq, their Kobe is Dylan Harper or
that's the crazy thing,
Jared Fox or Stephen Castle, and they're not up to that task yet.
Certainly not. And that was the thing, is that the Spurs, you could argue, have the best guard core in the league. They've got Fox, Harper, Vassell, and Castle. That's four really good guards, but they don't – all of those are B-plus type of guys. I really love me some Harper, and I think he'll grow into that role. But I do think it's telling that they actually give the backup point guard role, quote-unquote, really more to Castle than they give it to Harper. And between Castle and Fox, their decision-making has been – like, they make some of the dumbest decisions. Again, I'd be sick if I were a Spurs fan today. There were so many blown possessions. Castle only took one shot the entire second half. Harper, I think, went 2 for 5 or so. And I think he projects to be that dude eventually. But he's a rookie, man. That's a huge ask on a guy like that.
Yeah, when you say B to B plus, I want to make sure that we're talking about the same sort of thing. You mean as like an on-ball driver of offense, right?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for that distinction. So we're talking Luka, Brunson, Shea, those type of guys that you give them the ball. Even Jokic. Jokic works as a big man because he is one of the great passers and ball handlers of all time, especially passing in a way that it's not one of the greatest passing bigs of all time. He's just one of the flat out greatest passers. And so that ability to score himself and distribute, that's not really what those guys do. They're power guards. I think most of those guys are two guards, with the exception of Fox, who again, this morning, I'm just like, what the hell were you thinking? I was rewatching a lot of the second half and just so many dumb plays that when your point guard, your main guy, that there's a thoughtfulness to that that you need to have, that just like that last play, man, like what is he doing taking that layup? And he explained, he was like, I thought I'd beat OG to the rim. And it's like, if you got the breakaway layup, yeah, take that shot. But you didn't have that. And it just, there were so many bad plays that watching them combust and not know how to get out of it. I was thinking, like, if that's Brunson on their team or if that's Luka, you're going to get some buckets out in these key circumstances that sort of stem the tide and stop the bleeding in a way that they never could.
Yes, and that's a different class of player, right? Shea is like that as well, right? Where you're just like, well, we can just give you the ball and you're going to be able to get to a spot and create something. And the fact that Brunson can do that as like a 6-foot player is sort of unreal with the level of ball pressure that he's facing. But the Spurs didn't have that at all. And it stood out like a neon sign. Their inability to course correct, to veer back in the right direction and say, no, 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 this is what we need on this possession. And there just was not that care factor, and there was not that caretaker of an offensive player. And beyond that, even if you don't have that sort of like, oh, I'm going to take care of the ball here, and we're going to, like, old school point guard stuff that we grew up with as children of the 1980s, there was definitely a job description for being a point guard. And if you held that title, then you needed to understand these parts of the game. There's very few of those sorts of guys left. And so I don't expect all of these guys to be like, oh, you know what we need to do is let's get into this action and you go over here and point over there and yada, 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 right? But what you do need then, if you're not going to be that guy, is it's like, all right, well, can we go 1-4 flat and I can just get to a spot and just do this thing, and I'm going to understand what is needed and play and get you a playoff basket. Mm-hmm. And the Spurs didn't do that at all, Pete. They settled for long jumpers.
They took forever to get into their action, too. There were so many plays where, like, they're figuring out what are we going to do, and now there's 7 seconds left on the clock. You haven't even launched an attack yet.
And then they're rushing then. And then what does it lead to? It leads to another contested jumper. And I just thought the Knicks defense, It's probably going to get lost within the idea of how much the Spurs shit their pants.
Yeah. Right?
But they didn't do that without the Knicks running around with the key to the bathroom and being like, nope, you're not getting in. You know what I mean? So the Knicks had their hand in this as well. Let's take our second break here. And when we come back, I want to forecast a little bit forward with this and then wrap up the finals and then maybe switch up. The other part I wanted to say, Pete, is just like we highlighted Fox to a certain degree and Wemby to a certain degree and Brunson to a certain degree. Ananobi was just a monster.
Yeah.
He's on the sort of run. This is like his ceiling, right? This is his peak in terms of his shot making, his defensive ability. But he plays a role, Pete, where he also doesn't have to do a ton of shot creation. Like Brunson and then Alvarado, I thought, was like key in this aspect as well. It's like another ball handler within what the Knicks were doing is that Ananobi was able to be a finisher, but was doing it at such a high level while also being a great defensive presence that it just slotted him perfectly in this. And he's excelling at a role that every team would love to have a guy who's playing the way that Ananobi's playing right now. He made the two biggest plays of his career in basically a minute and a half sequence that capped off the greatest comeback basically in NBA history.
Yeah.
We could talk about the finals or whatever, but
because
it was
the
finals, it is the greatest comeback in NBA history, and put his team on the precipice of winning the NBA championship. And like that block and that tip-in, they're going to live forever.
Yes. No, just he's been phenomenal. It's incredible. They've got three guys, I think, that have a legit argument for MVP of the finals at this moment between Brunson, Towns, and OG. To your point about it being his ceiling, yes, he benefits from the shot creation of Brunson, and Brunson being that guy you do give the ball to pretty much every play. But I've been stunned at his self-creation at the end of shot clock on plays that have been busted. He has saved so many possessions with his individual shot creation on plays that are super low yield normally that he's just stuck so many of those jumpers. And that was the thing, too, is that we went about a game and a half or so with the Knicks where they weren't knocking down every clean look. But by that second half, they were doing it again. Every time they got a good look, as hot as the Spurs were in that first half, the Knicks were doing that as well. And OG's just ability to do that, but also make plays like that last tip in. He got that huge running start, which always gives you an advantage for being able to jump high. And he beat both Castle and Harper to that rebound. But if you watch the replay in slow motion, all three dudes are way up there. And as a Laker fan, I was like, I think Adu's the only guy on the team that would be getting as high as any of these three guys because Castle and Harper didn't have the advantage of the running start. So they're basically a standstill jump, which you don't get quite as high off of that, but they still can get up. But in a series where you've got so many athletes and wing guys and supporting players, he's the biggest of them all. That was one of the things that stood out to me prior to the series was like, damn, Spurs have a lot of guards, but the Knicks are more of that classic, we've got wings. And as has always been true in basketball, D, all things equal, size matters. And I've thought that he's leveraged his size to go along with his skill and all of that. Like he's shown himself to be the best of that bunch. And I don't think it's a coincidence that he's the biggest.
No, there's a physicality that he plays with just based off of his body type that matters within the context that you're talking about. It's not just that he's taller. It's that he's just got strength and his stature and the way that he's able to stand in there. And then you add in the athleticism. He's gotten multiple dunks with like Wemby in the vicinity. He had another one this last game where he got a great cut. Wemby was sort of like late in tracking him and Ananobi broke free and got that right-handed dunk slashing down the lane. And he's gotten two dunks right where he's like beaten Wemby and sort of bodied him off and finished around the basket. And he's just a physically strong and knows how to leverage that to be effective around the basket. And then also to create space on some of those end of clock possessions that you're talking about. Some of those are drive, reverse pivot, and then shooting a really tough turnaround jumper that's like a 15-footer or something. Those are playoff shots, but his strength and ability to sort of stay on balance and knock a guy off, that's what all of that's about, right? And there's a reason why my ears perked up when, after the Lakers drafted Thero, they said like Ananobi is sort of the peak level idea for what they want from Adu. The thing about OG though, Pete, is like he's always been able to hit the corner three and like he's knocking those down with regularity. And so he's just the ultimate 3-and-D player who makes $40 million a year because he's that good at all of these aspects. And that's a rare sort of guy like Aaron Gordon. Yeah. Type, right? There's like, what, maybe three or four of these guys in the entire league that do it to this level.
They're so valuable. And I think that they are really the modern archetype for the power forward position at the highest levels of basketball is somebody that has just a multiplicity of skill, but brings a level of athleticism and physicality to that, while not needing him to be the guy you give the ball to, but can do all the other stuff. And like you said, there's only a small handful of those guys. Just super valuable having that. The one last thing I wanted to get your thoughts on is I thought they really went at Wemby in that second half. And as a Laker fan, I think the thing that, you know, we have so many pods about, what are we learning from all of this and how can we apply it to the Lakers? I think the thing that I've moved on the most is the necessity of having a five outlook. That was something that I believed we needed and would be good to have prior to the playoffs. Now I think it's a necessity to be able to win this style of basketball because seeing these teams have to flip from one to the other to be effective, and every single one of them has that type of look that I thought that the Knicks really found something with Kat out there and being able to space the floor in that way. They generated in the second half in pick and rolls that Wemby was involved in, it was like 1.7 points per possession. And he's supposed to shut that down. And I just think the ability to space the floor at all five spots is really crucial to being able to do that.
Not only that, Pete, but I think it's important that the player who Wemby ends up on is able to space the floor above the break, right? Ooh, and so one
not
of
just
the things—
corner.
One of the things that the Spurs are doing with Wemby defensively is whenever the player who Wemby is guarding goes to set a screen, Wemby is passing him off to one of the other players up there so that he could essentially play a one-man zone. And eventually, he ends up on someone where they run multiple guys and then he has to go up and screen. And then the guy that he's on, if that player can shoot above the break, then Wemby feels like he has to stay connected, right? And what they've been doing is they've been running through these cycles of players until it's Towns. And this is what they were doing in the second half, and especially in the fourth quarter, where ultimately then it was Wemby's on Towns again, and then Towns is spacing above the break, and Wemby had to stay connected. And he can challenge three-point shooters in the corner, particularly if that player is a guard. He challenged a Deuce McBride corner three in the first half, and McBride shot that shit where it went like above the shot clock. Like, and like he missed it so bad. It's just like these are hard shots when he's bearing down on you in the corner, particularly if you're a smaller player, that I don't think you can rely on it just being a five-out look. If he's allowed to just stay in the corner the entire time.
Because he can still be the low man.
You have to have the ability to bring him up above the break in order to open up all of the driving lanes and then the real corner kick out threes to your better shooters when it's not Wemby who is the player who's closing out on them. And I thought the Knicks being able to scramble San Antonio's defense to get to that look specifically where Wemby was above the break, that was one of the key elements to the comeback, I thought.
Such a crucial distinction. I'm so glad you made this point. And that is important in the team building aspect is that if we do get that look, that player not just spacing out to the corner, but being able to pull their man beyond the free throw line is essential. Because otherwise, they just get to be a low man, basically, and can still affect the game. Really, really good point. All right, going to wrap up here a little bit early. And tomorrow we're going to have a Lakers team building pod. But until then, you've been listening to the Laker Film Room Podcast. We'll catch you guys next time.
Baines has got it in low to McHale. McHale wants to turn. He's double teamed. Just pass out of front. Broken up by Worthy. Tip to Magic. Worthy dies on his belly. Magic scores.
And Magic got it. Magic fires. It's in. The Lakers win the game. The Lakers win the game. Rebound of Lottie. 3 seconds left. Van Exel to win it. It's on the way. Good.
Kobe Bryant. 48 points. 16 rebounds. Shaq with his eighth block.
an NBA Finals record.
A lot of Laker fans sticking around for this.
You're seeing something that's very rare indeed. A Laker to get MVP chance
right, in Boston.
In Boston.
Of all places.
Are you kidding me?
Kobe. Hard to believe.
Are you kidding me? Unreal. Are you kidding me?
Lakers looking to push. Bryant spinning in the lane. Back for Gasol. Pretty pass. And it's back to a three-point game.
Kobe Bryant picked up by Bell.
There's the move.
Two. One. Miss it.
Bryant. Unbelievable.
It's over.
Shot clock now to five.
Bryant.
Yes.
And that was a little tough to Alvin Gentry.
Add insult to injury, Kobe. I mean, what a shot. I mean, you can't defend that. Are you kidding me?
2.1 seconds remaining. Denver a foul to give. Jokic trying to disrupt Rondo. He puts it in. Here's Davis. 4-3 in the win. Oh, it's good. Anthony Davis has won it for the Lakers. James again. Oh, he hits another one. LeBron James putting together a closing quarter against the Nuggets.
This historic 2020 NBA championship belongs to the Los Angeles Lakers. The Lakers conquer the bubble, and banner number 17 will soon hang in the rafters.